This week, we learn about the Cathars, the strange French Gnostic group that had a great opportunity to oust Catholicism. We'll tackle the history of this enigmatic group. Then, we'll tackle a topic that is rarely, if at all, ever covered, the esoteric significance of the stewards. We hear so much about the junior deacon and the wardens, never about the stewards. So, this week, get ready for an awesome journey into that symbolism of those two less written about and less celebrated positions within the Masonic Lodge. Finally, we'll wrap it up with an amazing piece from Mark St. Cyr as he continues the Lodge Education Application Series. This week, he's given away the biggest secret, whether Lodge, Society, Nation, Kingdom, you name it. If you want things to change, there's only two options. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 614. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the program. Without you, we cannot make the show. And if you're out there thinking, gee whiz, I listen to this show every week and I'd love to help out, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options we have available, from monthly gifts to one-time gifts, whatever fits for you. Heck, even a dollar helps out. The first piece I have for you this week is something that I find to be fascinating. I've read many of the books by Lomas, I've read books by Bajent, and all of these sort of, well, they might be classified as pseudosciences. Of course, there have been specials on things like H2 and the never-ending memes criticizing H2 for a lack of historical content and a promotion of pseudoscience and aliens. But amongst all of those things, we have tiebacks to some of the more captivating stories that the public has latched onto and has taken some of these niche topics and made them more accessible. Ideas like Christ having a wife, or having a holy bloodline, or any number of other tales, mythologies, and religious ideologies have been brought into the public eye. Think no more than something like the Da Vinci Code. People's knowledge of things like the Priory of Sion went from nothing to, heck, probably 60-70% of the people interested in these kinds of things now knew all about it, and perhaps the hoax and everything else. So with that, I wanted to read this piece that I found on philosophicalsociety.org, which talks about Catharism, or Catharism, and perhaps a connection to Masonry, but if not Masonry, then perhaps something else. Perhaps something more divine. Catharism, the strange history of the 13th century French Gnostics. In the old province of Languedoc, northwest of Marseille, on the resplendent Golfe du Lion, emerged the Cathars, a mysterious Christian sect shrouded in accusations of heresy in the 11th and 12th centuries. The sect centered on the quaint town of Olby, bearing the mantle of Albigenses, the moniker Cathar, taken from the Greek katharos, means unpolluted or pure, and was a testament to their unwavering devotion towards life of asceticism and pursuit of spiritual purity. Early whispers of the strange belief system had drifted initially from the far corners of Eastern Europe, carried by traders who wove tales of Bogomils and other Christian sect deemed heretical by the Orthodox Church. But where these beliefs had little success elsewhere in the Mediterranean, in Languedoc, they would shape the spiritual landscape, even threatening Catholic supremacy. Cathar theology, the dance of dualism. Departing profoundly from the Orthodox Christian doctrine, Cathar theology plunged into the turbulent waters of Manichaean dualism. This perspective cleaved the world into realms of good and evil. Matter and worldly experience were intrinsically evil, while the ethereal realms of mind and spirit were pure and good. Such a philosophical stance fueled a fervent anti-clerical zeal and led to a stringent ascetic lifestyle, devoid of earthly pleasure. They sought nothing less than to transcend the mortal plane and achieve absolute spiritual purity. For those familiar with Gnostic ideology, alarm bells will be ringing. Indeed, the Cathar Creed is fundamentally Gnostic at its core, acknowledging the existence of two gods. The first was a malevolent deity, the sovereign of all visible and material realms and author of the Old Testament's atrocities. The second is a benevolent deity, the beacon of Cathar devotion and the originator of Jesus' message. Fearing one and worshipping the other, they followed the teachings of Jesus to the letter, defying the Catholic Colossus. The tenets of Catharism often found themselves on a collision course with the edicts of the Catholic Church, particularly in issues concerning poverty and the moral character of priests. Long before the Protestant movement, the Cathars argued for public access to the Bible, promoting vernacular translations into local languages. Such unshackling of religious scripture was a brazen affront to the Catholic Church. Leading the Synod of Toulouse in 1229, they castigated and condemned such translations, barring lay people from owning a Bible. That was not all. The Catholic retaliation was terrible. Secular rulers were ordered to maim and torture all heretics, targeting any who dared refuse to conduct such horrific tasks. The Fourth Lateran Council escalated this symptomatic persecution, sanctioning the confiscation of Cathar lands and properties. If moral condemnation did not shift rulers' hands, monetary incentives certainly did the trick. Unholy Crusades against Cathars. In a move that would etch a dark chapter in history, Pope Innocent III initiated a crusade against the Cathars' heretics, turning this suppression campaign into a bloody military offensive. Peter Castelnau, the appointed papal legate, tasked with leading the Catholic counteroffensive against the Cathars, met a tragic end at the hands of an assassin allegedly employed by Raymond VI, the Count of Toulouse, and protector of the Cathars. This act was the spark that ignited the crusade, turning a religious rift into a full-blown military onslaught. In the year 1229, a dreaded inquisition was set upon the Cathars. The transition of control of this inquisition to the Dominicans marked the beginning of a bleaker area for the beleaguered Cathars. Accused of heresy, they were stripped of rights, while those bearing testimonies in their favor risked being ensnared in the net of heresy themselves. Bernard Guy, the notorious inquisitor, offers a chilling summary of the Cathar position in his writings, depictions their perception as, quote, good Christians who were, despite their peaceful and devout ways, relentlessly haunted and branded heretics by the church. They viewed their plight as mirroring the persecution of Christ and his apostles by the Pharisees. Cathars, a lasting legacy. Despite being centered in Languedoc, the echoes of Catharism resonated across Western Europe during the 11th century. The Netherlands, several German states, and even the far-flung Byzantine Empire were marked by Cathar influence carried along bustling trade routes. Their faith painted a vivid cosmological picture, two gods locked in an eternal dance of dualism. The good God of the New Testament was credited with the creation of heavens, light, and souls, while the bad God of the Old Testament was seen as a jailer of souls, imprisoning them within human bodies and ruling over all material things. Their deeply held conviction promised the liberation of a virtuous soul from its corporeal cage, granting its passage to heaven, while a sinful life led to another round of imprisonment. Following the brutal Inquisition, peace was declared with the Treaty of Paris, in which the French king disposed of the House of Toulouse of much of its fiefs. For the next century, the Catholic Church would hunt down all remaining Cathars in a merciless onslaught. In fact, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, described the Albigensian Crusade as one of the most conclusive cases of genocide in religious history. So thorough was the task that by 1350 the sect had been systematically destroyed. Another forgotten group, lost to history. I really like this. It's a high-level overview of things. And in fact, there are a ton of great books on the Cathars. Some of my favorites I'll put in the show notes, and do include some books that might be considered a little out there, a little pseudoscience, but they're a fun read nonetheless, books like The Jesus Papers and others. Very interesting stuff. Next up, a piece by our good friend and one of my contributing authors to How to Charter a Lodge, a no-nonsense, unsanctioned guide. Christine Wilson Slack, 33rd Degree, writes, of the stewards. Freemasonry is a tradition steeped in symbolism. Everywhere one looks in a lodge, there can be found a new symbol, a new dimension of meaning waiting to be discovered. The stewards, officers of the lodge, conduct the ceremonial work, but what deeper elements of our mystic understanding do they reveal? Freemasonry is a solar ritual, designed to mark the sun's movement throughout the year. While other esoteric and religious institutions track the moon, Freemasonry uniquely ties with the sun. The principal officers of a Masonic lodge mark the times of the day, and with their moving counterparts, their deacons, they mark the times of the year. This is very specific to the officers in the east and west, where one marks the summer solstice east and one marks the winter solstice west. The south also marks the sun, but in the equinoxes of the year, the sun is directly overhead at noon. This is where I believe the stewards come into play. While the officers in the east and west have their moving counterparts, so does the officer of the south, the junior warden. In his Principles of Masonic Law, Brother Albert Mackey stated that the stewards are appointed by the junior warden and sit to the right and left of him in the south. This makes sense if they represent Capricorn and the Tropic of Capricorn, which is in the south. This is further evidenced by the symbol associated with the steward, the cornucopia. In antiquity, the cornucopia was called the Horn of Plenty. It symbolized abundance and nourishment, commonly a large horn-shaped container overflowing with produce, flowers, or nuts. Traditionally, the horn was a goat's horn, as noted above, and is associated with Capricorn. The stewards sit on opposite sides of the junior warden, but are not to the extremes of being in the west or the east. This indicates that they are a midway point between the two, marking the solstice periods. The reason for this may become a little clearer if we look deeper into both the astrological sign of Capricorn materially and esoterically. The sign of Capricorn has three flavors, that of the river goat, the land goat, and the mountain goat. Together they represent a cycle of life. I believe this is the spiritual life, not simply the physical life. Starting in water, the emotional realm, we move to subdue those emotions as we begin on an esoteric path. We move toward the land. However, this is the land of all men, not the land of those on the path. The mountain goat represents the man who is striving, yearning for that higher self and for continued improvement. He is still of earth, but he has lifted himself beyond the simple ideas of the physical and emotional worlds. The female goat generally represents nourishment and abundance, while the male goat often is a sign of stamina and virility. Both are representative of abundance and fecundity. The horn traditionally represents the masculine when it is point side up, representing the giving of abundance, the point side down representing the feminine and receptive principle. Capricorn is also an earth sign, representing practicality and the life-giving nature of earth. It is grounded and rich with the cycle of the entire earth, birth, life, and death. The sign is ruled by Saturn. Cancer and Capricorn begin their cycles on the summer solstice and winter solstice, respectively, and it's appropriate to discuss a little of the tropics they represent. The tropics are the longitudinal lines on Earth where the sun can be seen directly overhead on their respective days. In the area between the tropics, the sun has little movement and may generally be seen directly overhead at any time of the year. This tropical zone is considered also the most temperate place on Earth, and seemingly where human life on Earth began. Here, let's turn back to Freemasonry. In all of these discussions regarding light and the sun, it is important to remember that Freemasonry is a Northern Hemisphere-focused ritual. and as such is focused primarily on the symbolism of the Northern Hemisphere. This is not to say Freemasonry isn't practiced or relevant to the Southern Hemisphere. I mention it here only to inform readers that some of this terminology may need to be reversed to be applicable. The junior warden has a responsibility to mark the sun at high noon, according to some. This is both a physical place and an emotional one. The physical is clear when the sun is directly overhead. This seems obvious. However, it is also the place of no shadow and the clearest vision. Everything is visible and illuminated. This leads to the emotional meaning of the phrase, which is a crisis or event that is likely to decide finally what is going to happen in a conflict or situation. It appears to be the place in which the ultimate decision of that which is made manifest is decided. Could this be a link between the junior warden and inner guard? Let's also look at the south as a place of beauty. Beauty can be felt and seen, but it is generally seen. One needs light to see beauty made manifest. Therefore, it seems logical that beauty would reside in the place of greatest light, that where the sun is always overhead. I think there is also something to the point that the Tropic of Capricorn is the southernmost point of least light to people of the Northern Hemisphere. This appears to represent the moment before sunset where the darkness begins, which seems to be under the influence of the West or the senior warden. Consequently, we see the idea of the North as a place of potential, a place of antithesis of light. While the stewards frame the place of greatest light, their mirrored selves frame the place of greatest darkness. But this is not pure darkness. It is the darkness that is visible to all, which shows us the contrast to the positivity of the light. In other words, we all need to have a point that we can understand what is dark and where do we need to tread to stay in the light. Lastly, the stewards represent the idea of abundance and plenty within the realm of thought and ideal. That is, there is a universal plentitude that is there to help us empower our higher consciousness and spiritual attributes. Awareness, the ability to see and experience more beyond this physical realm, is perpetual, just as the cornucopia is perpetual in its plenty. I'm not speaking about material goods, but about the light that lifts us to a better humanity. The stewards mark and do much esoterically for the lodge and the ritual. While they might seem like a minor role in the ritual at play, they have a greater purpose to the solar meaning and symbols within our work. They encourage us to look to our inner steward, the one who reminds us of the abundance of the divine and of the universe, and that which guides us on a path of light. Here's why I like this. It directly ties ideologies of solar worship, which we know existed from time immemorial, and likely is part of the systems that were borrowed by Masonry when amalgamating those rites into what would become the Masonic degree system. I like the science that's proposed, direct links to everything, sounds really awesome. And I love that Christine went in here and said, quote, "That is, there is a universal plentitude that is there to help us empower our higher consciousness and spiritual attributes." And I think, lastly, I would say on this other positive note that there is little to nothing written in my eyes that is satisfactory regarding the symbolism of the stewards. Mackie doesn't do a great job. Neither does Waite or Coil. There's nothing really awesome in the realms of symbology. Even the books on symbology that I have fail to mention the stewards. I have to absolutely commend Christine for tackling this subject and for decoding some of this great symbolism that we have in our fraternity.
The Once Came You podcast, I'm Mark St. Cyr with this week's installment of its Education Application Series. First, as always, the disclaimer. The following viewpoint does not represent any Grand Lodge or concordant body and is solely that of the presenter. Please be sure to check with your jurisdiction's rules for governance relating to anything discussed here before considering any application thereof. So with that said, let's dig in. In prior episodes, we started with the overarching premise of culture within the crowd. Then we went through some examples for context. Well, at first blush, it could be viewed as another cry fest of an issue we're all too familiar with. Trust me, I get it. However, what we had to do before anything else is set a baseline with real examples as to apply real-world solutions that move the needle in the correct direction. So now let's move to application regarding culture, which is how to change it. Well, to quote Run DMC, it's tricky. In other words, when it comes to changing culture, you can't. That's right, I just said you can't, and I mean it. So what's the solution, you ask? Great question. And it's this. A culture can't be changed. It can only be replaced by a conformity. Now, before a bunch of you get your aprons in the twist, let me add a brief clarifier for this discussion. Regardless of what is stated in management guru books, the idea of going in and changing a current culture, which is failing, on the fly, into something that will become, let's say, productive, innovative, and or prosperous going forward, is as much a myth as turning lead into gold. It's both pointless and useless. So what does this idea of replace by a conformity truly mean from an application standpoint, using the craft as our example? Well, let's sum it up this way. If your current culture sounds a lot like a "we don't do that here" or something similar, understand you will not be successful trying to implement any lasting change of any kind through the rubric of logic or reason to foster a yes into a no. Even if you do get some consolation gift in the form of, "well, maybe we'll give it a try, we just need to get some more input, blah, 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 blah," it'll all be hollow. Try to the culture club is usually nothing more than shutting you up with a one-off or maybe a two, then, at first opportunity, it'll be nixed one way or another. For you will be fought at every juncture, undermined at every turn, even absurdly rejected for trying with something that sounds a lot like, "hey, we gave it a chance and it failed, don't blame us." Here's where you must fully come to grips with the maxim. A person changed against their will is of the same opinion still. These aren't empty words. This applies to singular people, groups, organizations, neighborhoods, cities, states, all the way through the nation. In other words, cultures don't change. They change only by being replaced through a process known as conformity. Everywhere you look, this is played out through history. The new culture imposes itself on the former, making itself the dominant arbiter of all rules going forward. The former culture that is being absorbed into the newer is not changed per se by a belief, acceptance, or anything else, other than it conforms to the new norms. Or said differently, they are changed via their conforming to the new, whether they like said change or not. Conformity is that change. But most are not comfortable with such a premise, so they never think of it. Why? Because getting conformity not only requires the authority to demand it, it also requires the will to use the levels of power to enforce it, whatever they may be. In other words, conformity is where and how change happens. Period. Full stop. But conformity must have legitimate, recursive enforcement to ensure that conformity. For without it, you just get disarray. So before one begins, you'll have to find where and what that pressure point is for your situation. And enforcement can come in many forms, such as peer pressure, social pressure, legal, or other authoritative aspects. But understand, without it, the existing culture will wear all of you down into defeatism. This is why when you walk into so many differing operations, you can just feel a sense or lack of enthusiasm everywhere or anywhere within it. Usually, it's because this process is in play. Here are some examples. People appear to not just be going through the motions to fulfill their tasks. They're actually robotic. And they talk almost robotic, if not actually so. Autopilot seems to fit as a description for every interaction that you deal with. Clicks abound. and they're obvious to even the casual visitor, for they huddle in close quarters in full public view. You've all experienced this. Ever walk into a store or office space and see a huddled group of employees talking to each other, and they'll act as if you just insulted someone's mother if you dare ask for help or service? These are just some of the signals you should pay acute attention to, because the odds are very high, no matter how prosperous that entity may appear, the current culture is sowing the seeds for its own demise. It's just a matter of time. So for our application purpose, what is one to do if we're talking specifically about, say, like reestablishing Masonic education in their lodge meetings as an example? Well, based on what we've covered, you only have two options. The first, whatever the current culture is, you have to formulate both a vision as well as a plan that others can easily understand and would commit to. Emphasis on commit. Also, understand it's not a one-man show, even if you're the current worshipful master. Why? Because the current culture will just wait you out. Then, it'll go back to where it was. However, you will need someone in a position of authority to impose compliance, whether it's an actual position such as someone in the line, or inferred status that carries weight such as, again, maybe a past master, a past or present district grand master, a past or present grand line officer. I mean, you get the idea. You will also have to get real comfortable real fast with the idea that not only will you not be thanked for anything, you're going to be the primary focus for all backlash, whether warranted or not. And when it comes to any thanks, forget about it. Trust me on that one. To reiterate, only via some form of enforcement mechanism will they, in other words, that culture, conform to the new change. But that's how it works. It's knowing this distinction that needs to be fully appreciated for those daring to even try. Or said differently, this isn't for the meek at heart. Then there's option two, which is, the host of this podcast, Robert Johnson, just so happened to have written a concise booklet on how to begin today and charter your own tabula rasa, using all the best practices and daring you to be a shining beacon for any and all that may follow. And there you have it. Oh, and one last thing before we end. Remember that Run DMC reference? It's tricky. Well, if you don't think there's a Masonic connection there, just look up the official video on YouTube for yourself. It'll become obvious in about 15 seconds. So for the Whence Came You podcast, I'm Mark St. Cyr. See you next time.
Well, there you have this no BS look at exactly what is required in order to truly change anything that has a culture. If you think that it doesn't work that way, I'd urge you to look at the way nations in history have conquered nations, to look at the amalgamations of ceremonies and rituals that have been pulled in, changed, or amended to fit perhaps a new standard. One thinks of Rome right off the bat. So in this, how do you get it done? I have to thank Mark for the great plug of How to Charter a Lodge. It is absolutely a pretty concise book that I hope people get their hands on, and if they are sincerely interested in starting a lodge, they'll see that it isn't that hard. But you know what you need? Dedication. You have to be 100% in. And even in the best of cases, such as what we did at Space Novum Lodge, and what countless other lodges have done in and around the United States at least, is you'll start with a bunch of guys that are full-fledged, on board. You couldn't hold them back from wanting to be a part of this new lodge. And yet, in the span of 3 years or so, you'll likely lose 25% of them. Why? What seems to fit in someone's life at a current point in time, a nexus, if you will, isn't always the same. Priorities change. When one brother starts down a path of chartering a new lodge with a bunch of other brothers that he is very much in tune with, if that brother has school or a job or a family, the lodge quickly can become the last priority, and someone you counted on, whom you needed in order to make this lodge work, is now absent. So you need to plan ahead. All that said, love the segment. Can't wait for the next one. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining, and one more time, thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. And if you're curious on how you can help, visit WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, click on the bookstore, click on the store in general so you can grab a producer's pin. Whatever you'd like to do to assist the show out, all is appreciated. Of course, links to all of our articles that we've read will be in the show notes. And that's it. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.